Life can grab a hold of you like captivating strings of color. It is a lesson that four women will learn as they each travel down a journey filled with lies, betrayal, and shocking secrets. Two-time number one Amazon best-selling author Marion L. Thomas brings you her riveting new book, Strings of Color. Critics call Strings of Color real and emotionally charged drama. Get your copy today at Amazon.com or order from bookstores nationwide.
To Authors First on the Artists First World Radio Network, artistsfirst.com. If you're an author, independent recorded artist looking for publicity, we'd love to help you out. Just give us a call, send us an email, follow the links we've provided on our homepage. If you have questions during Authors First, or if you're listening to the MP3 file, we encourage you to share the content widely all over the World Wide Web on your social networks and send your questions or comments to dj@artistfirst.com. This hour, it's my privilege, Tony Kaye, in the studio, my privilege to introduce Trish Knight. She's the author of The Crash of Nimrod XV-230, where she describes the conditions under which warfare was being conducted in Afghanistan. And I'd like to send out a special thanks to all of our military personnel worldwide. Thank you for tuning into the broadcast, for supporting the arts, and most importantly, for giving of yourselves so sacrificially for those of us in America. Thank you so much. And now, I'd like to bring our guest on. Let's give a warm welcome to author and mother, Trish Knight. How do you do, Trish?
Hello.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
You are now a crusader, an individual who has paid the ultimate price in losing a son at war, and now you join a very unique and special group of individuals who understand what the ultimate sacrifice really means.
Yes, a very sad group as well.
Well, thank you for your service to humanity and your son's service. And I know that these are grappling and difficult issues when they finally touch you in a personal way. And ultimately, your efforts led to the creation of a book.
Yes. But I didn't set out to write a book.
No.
I first began putting my feelings down on paper as a way of trying to make some sense of what was happening to me and as a way of freeing some space in my mind in order to for me to be able to face the next awful day that lay ahead at the time. So, I didn't set out to write a book.
Trish, introduce your son to our audience worldwide. Tell us about his youth, your relationship with him, his personality, and the treasures that you have in your heart and in your mind about his life.
Well, when he was killed, he was 25 years old. He was my youngest son, the baby of the family. He was loud. He wasn't like us. I tend to think of us as a quiet, reserved family, but Ben was loud, outgoing, cheerful, loved sports, loved most sports. you know, and he was very intelligent as well. He joined Mensa when he was just 8 years old. And, yes, he was a lovely young man that had his whole life ahead of him.
So growing up, he was very much exploring the creative side of his brain, his life, his intellect, interested in making contribution to society.
Yes, I'd say that, yes.
It takes a unique person, I think, to say, I'll put myself at harm's way and join the military from the beginning. At least that's the way it works here in America. Was your son drafted or did he enlist?
Sorry, was he?
Did he enlist in the service or did he was he dr- what we call drafted, brought in?
No, he enlisted. It was his choice.
So he volunteered. Yeah. And as I said, I think that is a part of a person's character when they say, I'll volunteer, I'll put myself in harm's way.
Yes, although I don't know whether he ever looked at it like that. From when he was young, he wanted to be an astronaut. And then when he got to 11 years of age, I think he realized that that wasn't going to happen. And he decided he wanted to fly and wanted to sort of join the RAF and fly. So I don't think he saw himself as putting himself in harm's way. It was just he wanted to fly as a career and decided to join the RAF.
Wow. Now, is this considered a six-year tour of duty or two or... What is that initial enlist?
I think he signed up for 10 years, but he only actually, like I said, he was killed after 5 years. But yes, he signed up for 10 years, and I think when that 10 years would have been up, I think he would have signed on again for a further number of years. He enjoyed... He enjoyed the lifestyle that being in the RAF provided for him.
And, of course, enjoying the technology and the things that he really wanted to explore.
Yes, yes, he did. And, like I said, he was able to satisfy his quest for flying. And, like I said, he liked the uniform, he liked the way of life that he got within the RAF, and he was very proud. I mean, he was just 19 and a half when he joined, and he was very proud to have joined the RAF.
The crash of Nimrod 10-5, that's an XV-230, a victim's perspective, can be found on Amazon.com. For your convenience, listeners, we have the web link provided next to our author's name, Trish Knight. And certainly it's easy to share that link with others. A powerful book, one that was not intended to be written but had to be written by the mother of a military son. And... The image, of course, of the Nimrod plane on the cover, the backdrop, the blue sky. It's a lovely book, well done, well made, well written, and certainly of incredible value. Kindle edition is only $9.30. You can buy them used for $17.98. This is such a modest investment for those who are serving in the military, for those of you who are interested in this topic. And I want to say that there is a subtopic to this. It's a victim's perspective, a victim's perspective. And so the book is framed after the research that our author did in investigating her son's death. So, powerful story. Now, your son went into the service. It was going to be a 10-year tour of duty. And how long was he active prior to the crash?
He went out. He flew out to the Gulf. I think he'd just been back out there just over 2 weeks when the accident happened.
2 weeks?
Yes, he came down. He came down from Scotland, where he was based in the north of Scotland. And in the August, he came down, drove down to visit us and for a bit of a holiday in July, in the beginning of August. And he was down here for about a week and then went back up to the air base and flew out to Afghanistan, like I said, about a couple of weeks into August. And he'd just been there 2 weeks when the accident happened.
What a devastating blow it had to have been on you and your family.
Yes, it certainly was.
Shock, disbelief, something's wrong.
We first heard about it. We first heard that there'd been an air crash by watching the 6 o'clock news, Sky News, on the Saturday, early Saturday evening. We came home about a couple of minutes to 6 o'clock, and I said to my husband that before I started getting something to eat, I'd just sit down and watch the news, the main headlines of the news. And the main headline was that a British military aircraft had crashed in Afghanistan.
And, of course, at that moment, neither you or your family were even beginning to think that he may have been on that craft.
No, initially they were saying they thought the aircraft that crashed was a helicopter, a Chinook, and I knew Ben didn't fly on helicopters, so I thought, oh, you know, he's safe then. But watching the news as it went on, they then said they thought it was a fixed-wing aircraft. Ben flew in a fixed-wing aircraft, but I think at the time on the news they were given out that they thought it was it might be a Hercules. A few moments later, that changed again, and they said they'd had it confirmed that the type of aircraft was a Nimrod, and Ben flew on a Nimrod. So, and I knew there were only a few Nimrods out there at the time, so. Yes, I began to panic then, and I came through and had a look on the computer to see if I could get, you know, more of an update. And like I said, I just kept looking on the computer and going back to the television to see if they'd updated it with more details. And it was about 7 o'clock, 10 to 7, I phoned my other son up, my eldest son, and asked him if he could come down, had he heard about the news that they thought a Nimrod had crashed, you know, and asked if he could come down, and he said yes, and he came down immediately. It only takes about 5 minutes, 10 minutes from where he lives to our house. He came down, and like I said, when he came in the house, he said, oh, there was a helpline number given out on the television screen, so I phoned the number. You know, it says it was a helpline number, so I expected help. I phoned the number, but they didn't offer any help. All they wanted to know was Ben's name, his rank, and his number, and they just said thank you, and that was it. So, you know, we looked again on the computers, and they then seemed to confirm, all the news items were confirming that it was a Nimrod that had crashed. So I said to my eldest son, I said, can you, because I've got three sons, I said, can you pop round to middle son, Matt? I said, pop round to his house and see how he is, see if he's heard anything. But I said, come straight back. So he said he would. So he went off. About 10 minutes later, the doorbell rang. I said to my husband, oh, that'll be Andy back. Ran to the door, opened it, expecting to see Andy, and there's two uniformed RAF people stood on the doorstep. So I knew they didn't need to say anything. I sort of screamed no. You know, I stepped back into the hallway, I suppose stepping back to get away from them to think no. And I just kept shaking my head in disbelief and saying no, no.
Every parent's nightmare, one that you've had many, many times since your children were born, became a reality for you in that moment.
Yes, yes. Although having said, saying that, yes, in one sense it became a reality, but I think I was very much sort of, in shock and in denial at that time, thinking, no, no. I mean, Ben always said to me, I suppose I have the advantage that we were close.
Yes.
And I could always give him a hug and say, I love you, Ben. And he would always give me a big bear hug back and say, I love you too, Mother. You know, and I'd always, when he was leaving to go back up to the airbase or go abroad, I'd say to him, be careful, Ben, I love you. And he'd say, I know, Mother, I love you too. And he'd say, we're so many miles up. He said, don't worry about me. We're so many miles up that nobody can get us. We're too high up. We're safe up there. And I believed him. I really believed him. And when the crash happened, I did initially, I wanted him in front of me. And I wanted to ask him, how did this happen, Ben? You told me you were safe. And I believed you. And I really wanted him. I was cross with him. I wanted someone to sort of bring him in front of me, you know, before I accepted what they were saying, that he was dead. I wanted to say to them, hang on, bring him here, I'll ask him myself what went wrong. So, you know, I wasn't, you know, my mind wasn't at its best at all.
Well, no, and you and your husband have each other, and that support and strength, I'm sure, has united your family in wonderful ways. And you'll always remember and treasure him. He was in pursuit of things that were meaningful, his life dreams tied up in this. I fear when someone gets on a motorcycle and they're young, and they're away from home or off to college, it can happen so quickly, so suddenly. Crossing the street to something mundane, and in this case, something that he treasured and wanted to pursue in service to the country, learning to fly, which was his lifelong dream, short-lived. But this trauma, you know, the loss of a child, you never recover from. Never.
No, you don't. You just gradually learn to live with it and to sort of accommodate the pain, but no, it's something that stays with you for the rest of your life.
Yes.
But I suppose I take comfort from the fact that Ben was doing what he wanted to do.
That's right.
He wanted to fly, and he was doing what he wanted to do. And although difficult for us, he would have much preferred, I'm sure, to go the way he did, as opposed to sort of living to the age of sort of 90 and 100 and sitting in a nursing home, you know. He saw the film Top Gun when he was a child, and from then he was sort of mesmerized by, you know, powerful music and, you know, powerful aircrafts, you know, and the romance side of it. And I suppose he was living his dream. That was, you know, I suppose one consolation is that he was doing what he wanted to do, and he would, I'm sure, have been, he would have thought that for the plane to explode and in midair, I'm sure he would have much preferred, if he had to die that way than to die just sat at home in his chair.
I'm very proud of the two of you for stepping forward to, you know, following your heart and saying that the memory of what happened needed to be preserved and writing this book.
Yes. Like I said, I didn't set out to write a book. I put it on paper initially because I felt I needed to. And it wasn't really, I suppose, until last summer, autumn, that I decided I'd release it to the general public.
It began as a journal for you, is that right?
Yes. I wrote things down at the time. At the end of each day, I'd sit and write it all down. I just felt it was such an awful experience. It hadn't ought to be forgotten. And I just felt as the years go by and I got older, memories would fade, you know, and some of those memories and important things, like I said, I didn't think should fade into obscurity. No. And I found it so difficult that only 3 months after Ben was killed, our first grandchild was born. And I felt so sad at the time as well that they just missed each other by 3 months.
Wow.
I mean, we now have a total of 4 grandchildren, and of course, none of them have ever met or had the opportunity to meet or know their Uncle Ben. So I wanted it, when I decided I was going to put all the journal together, initially it was just for the grandchildren, because I wanted them to be able to, when they're at an age, I mean, they're all under 5 at the moment, but when they're grown up and they're at an age where they want to read about it, they've got it's all there for them.
You'll see the traits of your son, Ben, in those grandchildren.
Yes. And in actual fact, my eldest son, Andy, his marriage, I suppose, came out of one of the things to come out of this whole tragedy, because he met his prospective wife while we were up in Scotland and dealing with everything that happened. He met his wife while we were up there. So, yes, his wife was a friend of Ben's. So, yes, it's strange how it all happens.
And here you are making an appearance on the Artist First World Radio Network with your host, Tony Kay. Thank you for spending this time sharing with you and your husband and family, telling us some intimate details about that tragic experience, that moment you discovered that your son was indeed in that plane crash. And I'm just so thankful that the two of you were strong in character and in love, and we're able to bring your family together. And as you mentioned, positive things have come as a result of that with your eldest son and so forth. And this book, and that all is a growing experience, as painful as it is. And now you're an author. You're on the Artist First Radio Network. You've joined the ranks of thousands who've graced our airways. We're broadcasting worldwide. We have listeners from every nation on earth. And Trish Knight, our hearts go out with you, and we understand what compelled you to do what you did in writing this book. It began as a journal. You worked on it for how long? Were you in the writing process before you discovered that you had some content that should be shaped into a book? Had you been writing a year or a matter of months?
No, I it must have been probably two and a half years.
Yeah. So you had a couple of years of distance, you know, and that helps, right? You know.
And when I initially sat down and began to type it, like I said, initially I wanted to put in a book form for the grandchildren. I sat and typed it out on the computer, and I'd sit there and be in tears. I choose to do it on an evening when my husband was out, because I would just sit and type away and be in tears and that. But the decision to release it to the general public, I wouldn't say I made that decision until I actually handed it over to the publishers in October last year.
October of 2011?
Yes, was when I made the decision that I'd get it published, I'd have it published for the general public.
Now, we've received a number of emails, questions regarding a blog or email or Facebook, or do you have other social networking sites? Let's just say that.
Yes, if people want to find out more, they can actually go on a site, benknight.co.uk.
And there you have photos and other information.
Yes, pictures when he was young, and yes, it explains everything. A lot of what we went through, and there's many pictures and videos and news videos as we sort of progress through the years and our struggle to get some sort of justice.
I was also asked to clarify the vessel. Yes. RAF Nimrod XV 230, and that was the mid-air explosion over Afghanistan in 2006. Is that correct?
Yes.
And Ben was not alone. There were others.
No, there was 14 on the aircraft altogether. Yes, and like I said, all 14 were killed. The plane caught fire shortly after air-to-air refueling. It caught fire, and there was no means of putting the fire out. They declared a mayday, and they were in the process of trying to land at Kandahar airfield, but they just didn't make it. The fire took too much of a hold, and the plane exploded in midair, and everyone was killed instantly.
Were you pursued after you were informed by others in the media?
We had a lot of dealings with the media, I suppose, but we needed their help, and they were very helpful. They produced many articles in the newspapers, you know, exposing the truth about the airworthiness of the aircraft. So I can only say really the media were of help. I mean, there were some television programs made, documentaries made about the Nimrod and the state of the aircraft.
Is the aircraft currently in use?
No. The Nimrod's MR-2, which was the type of plane Ben was in, eventually, a few years later, they were all scrapped. They were grounded initially, and then they flew again, but eventually they were all scrapped. And their replacement was also scrapped as well. I think, like I said, there was too much of a bad name that went with it after the crash.
Was the crash your son involved with, was that the only one associated with that particular craft, or were there others?
There was one that crashed in Canada a couple of years prior to XV-230. That one crashed at an air show in Canada. And there have been numerous faults with the Nimrod aircrafts. And problems with it flying. That has been going on for many, many years. And that some of them had fires on board, and but fires that they were only small fires that they could put out. But yes, there'd been many, many problems going on for a long time, and the RAF had just sort of accepted it and, you know, brushed it aside. And
now, your son Ben was on the Nimrod, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong, there were a total of 14?
Yes, there were 14 men altogether.
And now, is that how many it required to operate that aircraft? Or were they being
people.
Transported? Or?
No, there's 12 people in the crew. There was two extra people on there. There was one from the Special Boat Service and a Royal Marine, I understand. But normally, to fly those Nimrods, they had a crew of 12.
You wonder, you know, it doesn't seem very cost effective to use a vehicle, an aircraft like that, for such a small entourage of people. I suppose there are strategic.
I suppose what people would call a spy plane. So, like I said, the fuselage really was filled with equipment.
And you learned much of this information, of course, after your son was involved in the crash. Then that's when you really began to pursue with vigor the aircraft and all of its workings and history.
Yes, we did. And we found out then by people that helped us, people within the RAF that helped provide information for us. Yes, we found out that there was a lot wrong with these aircrafts way before the crash of XC-230.
Do you discuss in the book enough about the aircraft that those who have an interest in flying or who are presently pilots or in the military who fly, do you think they would have an appeal to the book, or is it tailored more toward the victim?
I think it was tailored more towards, yes, people who have lost someone, you know, people who have been bereaved. But having said that, it does go from chapter to chapter, explaining the whole situation we went through. Like I said, from first hearing about it on the 2nd of September, you know, to the repatriation ceremony when the bodies were brought home. It talks about, it's a chapter on saying goodbye to Ben and planning the funeral and everything that had to be done then. There was a mix-up of body parts as well, with a part of someone being put in another person's coffin. And it goes through the whole thing with the Board of Inquiry and the Nimrod Review, and then how the civil police investigation was, and the Health and Safety Executive and the RAF police. So it's quite a wide book.
Also, audience, you need to know that if you do a search, if you go to your search engine, you can also put in Silverwood Books out of Bristol. silverwoodbooks.co.uk to learn more about the book and the publisher and, of course, our author this hour. It was your intention to represent things as factually from your personal account as you could, because you wanted your grandchildren. You wanted your immediate family to have a remembrance and a reckoning of Ben.
Yes. Like I said, over the years, memories fade, and I wanted them to have as much detail about it as possible. I mean, some people have said to me that they were surprised how personal the book was. But I make no apologies for that. Yes, it is very personal in areas of it. One of the things I mentioned was the smell emanating from Ben's coffin at the funeral director's. But that was just how it was. It was an awful time in my life. And why should I disguise it into something more pleasant, into something it was not? It's fact. It's factual book and not fiction.
Yeah, so you did go into detail about the police investigation, health and safety, the RAF police investigation. You included some details about the research that was done, the investigation that was done after the crash.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I mean, the RAF police investigation.
Okay. Now, is that access through Freedom of Information?
Yes.
As we would have it here,
yes,
in the United States? So those were a matter of public record. You could go there and inquire as to what was going on.
But we were disgusted with how the RAF investigation went, because people within the RAF that were asked to provide an interview, to be interviewed by the RAF police, most of them, I think there was just two that gave an interview, all the others, to every question they were asked, all they said was no comment, no comment, no comment. I know they are entitled to say no comment, but I do feel if you haven't got anything to hide, well, why do you need to say no comment? And we were disgusted with that. We always thought the RAF was an honourable service, and you know, with honest people, and I just think that was quite appalling, and you know, replying no comments to every question.
You know, I think that wherever you are on either side of the shore, we have that overwhelming sense that we are just a number. We really don't matter, and people don't care up the line. They're more concerned about covering their own rears instead of getting to the bottom of things. Who's responsible ultimately, in other words, for systems and procedures, and how much of that do they feel they need to communicate with the general public, regardless of how connected we are to the event? And that is true of just the nature of government, unfortunately. And I'm not saying that it's right by any means, but you're not alone in that struggle to try to get answers from our government.
No, I realize that there's a lot of people trying to get answers.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can go right to the Senate, to the United States, or to the Congress, or you could even walk in and have a beer with the leader of the free world, President Barack Obama. You can go right there. Okay. But what, at the end of the day, what have you accomplished? You know, that's a big cog, a big wheel that so many layers. And that's what you encountered.
Yes.
With the RAF.
But we're not a military family, so we didn't mind who we wrote to or who we asked for information from, just because somebody high ranking was an air commodore or something like that. We weren't put off. Some people said, you know, when we said, oh, I'm going to phone air commodore so-and-so, some people said, well, you can't phone him. And I, you know, and I said, well, yes, I can phone anyone I want to. You know, my son has been killed.
Good
and
for
I
you.
Want to know, you know, who is responsible. So, you know, it didn't matter who I phoned. I, you know, if I wanted to phone or write to the Secretary of State, then we did so. You know, we weren't afraid of rank. We weren't put off by the rank.
And as a result, you probably learned a lot more than most.
Yes.
Because of that pursuit.
Yes, yes. Although ultimately, there has been no justice, sadly. No one has, although people have been named in the Nimrod Review, no one has had any action taken against them in the court of law regarding those 14 deaths. And I think that is disgraceful.
Have the other families and yourself gotten together at any point during this?
Oh, yes, yes. The families have, yes, got together at times and met up. And at the inquest, like I said, we were all there together for so many weeks. And then the Nimrod Review. And, yes, we meet up every so often, and there's we have made some good friends, and we've met some very kind people at the repatriation ceremony when the bodies were returned initially to Scotland, north of Scotland. The Duke of Edinburgh was there, and he was, you know, very, very kind. He came up and he spoke to us, and he was a very kind gentleman. And yes, we've had met a lot of very nice people and along the way.
Well-meaning
people. And some of them have taken risks in providing the information they provided for us.
That's admirable, wonderful. And that's what I mean, you know, the military, the government, it's a big machine.
Mm.
But there are those there, obviously, who have the interests of the public and can empathize and understand what we go through as parents losing a child in service or just crossing the street because we want to know. We want to know the detail. How did it happen? Who are these people? Could have been prevented. You know, who is at fault? You want to know details. You know, I think that pursuing that, along with finding a way to write your feelings, your emotions, the journaling you were doing for 2.5 years, you know, when you lose someone, it just isn't over at the funeral.
Oh gosh, no, certainly not.
And you carry all of that with you. You know,
I mean, in the Nimrod Review by Charles Haddon Cave, QC, he concluded, I think that book is over 500 pages, but it's well worth reading. He concluded that the accident to XV-230 was avoidable and that XV-230 was lost because of a systemic breach of the military covenant brought about by significant failures on part of the MOD, BAE Systems, and Kinetic.
Wow. You know, and there again, who wants to stand up and say, yeah, it was our fault. Yeah, we should have prevented that, you know. That's not the style of our government or the military.
No. But Ben was my child, and just because he's dead, I still felt I had a duty to him. You know, someone had taken his life, and he shouldn't have been taken. And just because he was dead, you know, it wasn't for me wouldn't be right for me to think, well, that's it. You know, I still have a duty to him as his parent to try, if at all possible, to bring those guilty of causing his death to account. And we haven't been able to, I'm afraid. I accept that now, that no one is going to be held accountable. It's wrong, but I accept that is how it is going to be.
Trish Knight, author of The Crash of Nimrod XV-230, A Victim's Perspective, available at Amazon.com. A good read, an emotional read, and something that those of you who have a heart for the military or have a son or daughter, perhaps, that you've lost in service, this is a great book of comfort and introspective and healing. And I congratulate Trish Knight and your husband and your children and your grandchildren for all pulling together in such a marvelous way to honor your son, Ben. Thank you for being my guest on the Artist First Radio Network. It's been my privilege to introduce you and this book to our worldwide audience. What are your future plans now, Trish, that this book is a reality? Do you intend on book signings, tours, public speaking? Do you have a sense of where you're headed next?
No, none of those really, because we're not that sort of family. I don't really think it's a book that I can do book signings for. Although people that have bought it that I know have asked me if I would sign their books, but it's not the sort of book that you would do book signing for. I mean, on page 34 and 35, you asked me earlier what Ben was like, but if people buy the book, on page 34 and 35, there is quite a long article written by Ben about when his father was seriously ill, dangerously ill in hospital, and Ben wrote a whole page of how he was feeling at the time. And like I said, he didn't show us. He had it on his computer, and it wasn't until he left to join the RAF a year or so after we found it and read it. And it's very sad, but it's a lovely piece in one sense, and it gives an ideal impression of what Ben was like. I mean, would you like me to read some of it out?
Yes, please.
Like I said, my husband had been taken seriously ill, and they didn't know whether he would live. At the time, Ben was away with the college on a course, and he came home at the weekend on the Friday. But this is what he wrote about it afterwards, a few months afterwards. Billions of stars float endlessly in the void of space, waiting for a dreamer, someone who would grasp them in both hands and hang on as if their very life depends upon it, as if it was a necessity like air or food. Everyone taking a different life route. How am I supposed to know which one to take? It might be the wrong one. I used to know, before Dad was ill. I was on a road and prepared to follow it for eternity. I thought it was the right way. To me, it was the only way. I don't think anyone ever truly knows where they are going. They just have a feeling in their heart and ride that feeling until it burns out. Mine did. I have always believed that to find true direction, you must push the physical limits of the body, push them until you can't take any more, and go on. When the wind is howling at your back and the mountains defying you, when all of hell is upon you trying to bring you down, then you find out who you are. I felt so helpless, so guilty that I wasn't there, so angry that I could not face to see him lying there, tubes hanging out like he was a machine. For 2 weeks, my father died. Each night, we would visit a shadow of my dad. These past weeks, he's been a father again. He's teaching me to drive. That's who he is, a teacher. A teacher whose job wasn't done. How dare he leave? He hasn't finished. What am I supposed to do? Teach myself? I don't know how to do anything without him. If Dad died, I don't think I could go on. He is my soul. He is the hand that rocks me as a babe. He is the sun that warms me on a summer's day as a child. He is the blanket that protects me at night. He is the air I breathe every second of the day. He is the determination that drives me. He is the strength that pushes me forward. He is my heart. Without him, there is nothing.
The words of Ben Knight, your son.
Yes, the words of Ben Knight.
And I believe there was a kinship there, an author in Budding, and I know he's smiling now at his mother for putting this together. Thank you so much for spending this time with us on Authors First, for sharing the life of your son, and for composing a wonderful book, well-written, and a beautiful read about a real life and real people. Thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations as you share this with the world, with those who have a need to understand and to share. So, audience, it's an emotional book, well written, as you can tell, and we invite you to buy the book and add it to your library, and of course, read it and share it, and get out there on the social network sites, and let people know about this marvelous book by Trish Knight. Thank you for being our guest. Before I let you go, anyone out there on planet Earth you'd like to say hello to?
No, not really. Just to everyone.